to the Home of Medicine podcast with me, Dr. Amy Burbridge. Welcome back to the podcast.
And hello again from me. It's Ben Lovell here, acute medicine consultant. And Amy, I've got a really fun case for you this week, if that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Go for it.
So there's a few strands to this case, and I think it's a short one, but I really enjoyed it, actually, and thought it might be fun to share. It comes from when I was on call as the medical take consultant. And my registrar, my fantastic registrar, was referred a case from A&E, from the ED, and it was a case of urinary retention, all right? So it was a 42-year-old woman who is 12 weeks pregnant, and she is G2P1, if you can remember what that means. So I always remembered it, G is how many babies, G is for grown, how many babies they've grown, and P is how many they've parted with. So G2P1, so she had two pregnancies and one previous delivery before. This is, so it's her second pregnancy. And she went actually to the early pregnancy unit at 12 weeks saying she can't pass urine very well. And the early pregnancy unit did a ultrasound scan and they showed a utopic, so normally cited pregnancy, which is appropriate for her for a date, and a distended bladder with 900 mils of urine in. And they sent her from the early pregnancy unit straight down to the emergency department. And the emergency team saw her and they gave her a catheter, actually. They catheterized her because she was in urinary retention. She was very uncomfortable with it, as you would be with almost a litre of urine in your bladder. And then they referred originally to the obstetric and gynae team, saying, here is your patient who's come from your early pregnancy unit. She's now come through us. She's in acute urinary retention. She's actually, since she's been catheterized, she's passed 2 liters of urine in 2.5 hours. So could you please advise? And the gynae team said, this is nothing to do with the pregnancy. This is nothing to do with us. We don't think there's anything obstetric or gynecological causing this, a case of acute urinary retention. And we don't think we should get involved. So the emergency department referred to medics for ongoing management of acute urinary retention in a young woman, 42, with what might be a post-obstructive diuresis. Because as we know, sometimes if someone's been in urinary retention, you put a catheter in and they suddenly go into this diuretic phase where they start passing enormous amounts of urine. You have to be quite careful they don't get dried out. So that's why she ended up with my registrar. And he went to see the patient. He elicited pretty much a normal examination from top to toe. And her blood tests were actually normal as well. Renal function was normal, no infection. And he came round to find me and said, I'm just treating this patient and I'm not really sure where to go next. We've treated the cause, i.e. we put a catheter in, but A, I can't explain what's happened here today, why this woman suddenly was unable to pass urine, and B, where do we go from here? Surely we don't just catheterize pregnant ladies and send them home again. That seems a bit risky, doesn't it? And I had to then come up with something intelligent to say. So you're now sitting in the chair that I was sitting in. What are your initial thoughts here, if you have any? And it's okay to say you have none, because my mind was blank at first as well.
Interesting one. First of all, my first question is, are the medics the right people, or would urology be the right people to maybe have a look at this case? But that aside, then started to think about, okay, so why is she in urinary retention? So drugs, so medications can often cause urinary retention. Has she changed any medication? Was she on any anticholinergic medication? Was this a neurological problem that had happened very acutely? Did she have any other signs or symptoms? Although I wouldn't have thought it would be that acute if I'm thinking along the lines of multiple sclerosis, but then also Border Equina syndrome. But again, she had no signs or symptoms. Her lower limbs were completely normal. Did she have any polydipsia? Was she really thirsty? Did she have polyuria because she had new diabetes? I'm really just thinking a scattergun approach here because I'm struggling. So I guess I could use my surgical sieve to try and think about what the causes are. So was there a vascular cause? Was there an infective cause? Did she have a urinary tract infection? Was there any trauma? Was this there any autoimmune causes or metabolic? We talked about diabetes. Was it something that we'd done to her? So around the 12-week mark, pregnant women have to have full bladder before they go for their 12-week scan. So did she have a really full bladder because she was going for her 12-week scan? Probably that falls pretty impressive, though. And then N is for neoplasia, so it's unlikely that there'd be an underlying malignancy. And D is drugs, which we've already talked about. So that's my thought process at the moment.
Which is pretty similar to ours. We had a discussion and the registrar was saying, look, is quadriquinol on the table here? Do we need to do a PR exam and think about an MRI spine? And my reaction was, hang on, hold your horses. She's got absolutely no back pain at all, no lower limb neurology, and no trauma to the spine, because we're thinking, is this going to be a cord lesion or a quadriquinol lesion? So I didn't like that, first of all. I said, let's just hold our horses on that for a minute. Other reasons, exactly as you said, I was like, well, has she just got a urine infection? I mean, pregnant women get urine infections, right? It's an immunocompromised state. Has she got really bad dysuria? And maybe that's called some urethritis and she can't pass urine, or she's in pain and so she's holding on. He says, no symptoms of dysuria. And we've actually dipped her urine and it's completely clean. So there's no leukocytes in it. There's no nitrites, no blood, no nothing. I thought, well, she's not going to have had a... What else could block the outlet of the bladder? She's not going to have a stone that sort of passed all the way down there without her having at least a modicum of flank pain, like a renal stone, or really bad urethral pain. I thought back to when I was an F2 in obs and gynae in the deep mists of time. And I remember that sometimes some women would get reemergence of herpes during pregnancy because their immune state was slightly lower and so it would reactivate. And I remember patients telling me that the pain was excruciating, urination. And so they literally, they couldn't do it and they would sort of hold on to it. And that's the only other thought I had. And I remember the treatment for this is, do you know what it is? If they're in so much pain with a reactivation of genital herpes that they can't pee, stuck with me. You actually have to pee in the bath.
In the bath, yes.
Yeah.
You have to sit in the bath and have a pee.
Get in a warm bath. And then you can try and pee into that. And it's just, that's one of the little nuggets that sort of sticks in your memory over the years. Anyway, it was all for naught because she did not have that. So it was for nothing. But that was the only other ideas that I had. And I just kept thinking, it's got to be related to the pregnancy somehow. I mean, it's just a weird coincidence. I don't know much about maternal medicine, obstetric medicine, although I do hold the diploma from the Royal College of Obs and Gynae, but so long ago, I've deleted all that information. So I didn't really know what to do from here. And I'm really interested in your point saying we're the right people to look after it, because my initial thought was, why the heck has this been referred to us? And that's not an unfamiliar thought your average acute medic or general medic has whilst working on the acute medicine take. I firmly believe that the emergency department have got a pretty good nose for referrals, and they get it right most of the time. But sometimes I do get referrals and I think something's gone awry here because I don't know if I'm the right person to look after it. That can actually take up a lot of bandwidth, a lot of decision-making bandwidth. I've become more sanguine with it over time, a more approach of like, well, they're with us now, so what will be, will be. But I remember being a reg, and I still see it in registrars now. They can get quite, I suppose, not offended, but morally quite injured when they feel that every other specialty apart from medicine has the rights to refuse except medicine. And then we end up taking people who other people don't want that really might not be under the right team. And we talk about getting it right first time a lot, which is truly important, but also from, I would say, a human factors or a decision-making point of view, it takes up a lot of time. And it's not unusual that I'll come in a morning and whoever was running the take overnight, the registrar will say, you will not believe the night I've had. I had a 4-hour conversation with these three specialties, all of who were refusing to take this patient. And I think it was unacceptable. And I want to be on their side, but I still think in my head, I think you would have had a better night if maybe we'd just taken the patient, made sure they were safe, and then you could have handed over to me the inappropriateness in the morning. And I would have looked into this. I would have, you know, worked out what had gone wrong overnight. And it's a shame that you spent 4 hours doing this, because I'm sure that impacted you. And it impacted your thinking and your reasoning, and also just the time management for you and your team for the rest of the night. That sounds really time consuming, being that emotionally agitated for quite a large portion of your shift. I don't know if this is a local phenomenon or is this something that you recognize as well?
Absolutely. And as you were describing it, I could feel myself having like reflections to being a registrar and getting so angry and so frustrated that you know, that referral has come to me and it was clearly surgical. Well, actually, nothing's clear in medicine. And I think the wiser I get, I'm going to not say older, but the wiser I get, I'm much more, like you said, a bit more sanguine and a bit more relaxed about referrals. There are still some that come through that I really struggle with. And I'm like, that clearly isn't for the medics. However, I will see the patient, I will make the diagnosis and then refer to the appropriate team, whether it be surgical, trauma, orthopedics, urology. And actually, I guess it's helping keep my skills up to date as well in the sort of pan specialty way. But then I worry about if the patient had been seen sooner by the right specialty, would they have been diagnosed earlier? Maybe. But I also really agree actually with what you said about overnight. And, you know, we often get people saying, I spent hours having this debate. Well, actually, don't have the debate. Have the debate in the morning and we'll have your back. And try and, you know, look after yourself. And because when you have those heated discussions, it can make you feel quite vulnerable and it can also make you feel quite cross and stressed. And that does impact on how you then interact for the rest of the evening and whether you sleep, whether you eat. So actually sometimes it's maybe, and I'm certainly a lot more like, it is what it is.
Yeah.
You know, and just, I guess, ride with it a little bit more.
And I think that comes with time where you sort of think, can I be bothered to have an argument? But I do know that when I come in and I get presented with that situation, what the registrar needs from me, it's their leader, is for me to say, oh my gosh, you were in the right. I'm going to deal with this and well done. And so I do try and tread the line of being supportive sort of line manager and also saying, listen, if this happens next time, you don't need to, or call me overnight. I'm paid to be on call overnight. And I think if there truly is a real disconnect and a real problem with where the patient's going to go, it has to go up to a consultant level. There's no point me saying, well, you go back to that specialty then and you tell them that I said no and that they should get, you know, you can't use registrar basically as messengers and pawns in a very complicated chess battle. You have to just pick up the phone as a consultant to a consultant and say, can we maybe solve this over the phone? There seems to be a bit of tension between the best care for this patient anyway. So, but I think that's an important, that one of the strands I'm interested in about this case. But going back to this poor woman who's now got a catheter in, is draining urine, but doesn't have a diagnosis. So I was a bit stuck here, I've got to confess. And people who listen to this podcast, often when they give us feedback or they talk to us about it, they say that it's interesting to hear what consultants do when they get stuck and what happens if the consultant doesn't know the answer. It's so funny. I was reflecting this morning when I was a medical student and I became a brand new doctor. I thought, oh my gosh, this means now that I have to know everything. Rubbish. Of course you don't. And then when I was a consultant, I became the medical registrar. I went, oh my gosh, now it's official. I'm supposed to know everything now. I have all the answers. Nonsense. I now know the retrospect. Being a consultant, I literally have no one above me to give me advice when I get stuck. Now I have to know everything. And I subsequently discovered that I don't, but I have to know where to source answers even when I get stuck. So I don't know about you, but a consultant doesn't know the answer. I ask my consultant friend, I ask my colleagues and say, anyone got any ideas with this case?
Yeah.
And I asked my friend, Claire. Claire Davies is a massively intelligent ED consultant friend of mine. And she messaged me back and I was looking at the exact word she sent to me this morning. She went, oh, I think this is a thing. And I didn't know what she meant, first of all. Because I'd said, what do you do in this case of this woman? She's 12 years old. And then she followed up with saying these magical words, which I love to hear. I've seen this before. I went, oh, she knows. If you want to know the answer to something, ask an ED consultant because they've seen everything. They have seen it all. If an ED consultant ever says to you, I've never seen that before. You've got a case report on your hands because you've got something super rare. But she said, I've seen this before. And she pinged me over a couple of case reports. One was from JAMA and from another cases about women who go into urine retention when they're 12 weeks pregnant. It's women with very retroverted uteruses. And what happens, I'm reading now aloud from a case report she sent me. When a retroverted uterus is pregnant, the bladder may not empty properly. As at 12 weeks, the expanding uterus becomes securely wedged between the os pubis and the sacrum, and the urethra becomes occluded at the level of the cervix. So I quickly looked online. I looked at all her scans from her last pregnancy, and I noticed they said at the top, ultrasound scan, retroverted uterus. I thought, oh my gosh, she's got it. I went back to the patient and said, I think I know what's happened here. It's due with having a slightly abnormal retroverted uterus. She went, oh, that's funny you say that. My uterus, they told me, was so retroverted when I had IVF. Like, they practically had to put the table upside down to get the angle right for the implantation. So that is true. And I think we nailed the diagnosis. And I looked at all these cases and they say the problem is completely gone at 14 weeks as the uterus lifts out of the pelvis, becomes a pelvic abdominal organ, and the urethra is able to function normally. And that's what it was. And it was a diagnosis made from a collaborative brain between consultants using someone who has got a massive library of previous cases tucked away inside and then can draw on it and say those wonderful words, I think I've seen this before. And that's where you start off on the track to a diagnosis. And it was really exciting, actually. And we were very, very excited to make this diagnosis. And boy, did we feel intelligent when we rang back Obs and Gyne and got to pontificate on a diagnosis we only learnt existed about 4 minutes ago, but explaining it to them. And, you see, now what's happened here is this. So now we think, so Obs and Gyne came and saw the patient. They discharged her, brought her back to their clinic a few days later for a trial without catheter. Didn't go so well. They brought her back another week later, whereby I assume the uterus was gravid enough to release the pressure, and she's doing very well. And that's the case.
Wow, that's really interesting. From a number of angles, it's not something I've ever heard of or ever seen. Obviously, you see so many people in urinary retention, but actually, if you've got, I guess, a pregnant woman who has sudden urinary retention and she's never had it when she's not pregnant, you think about this must be pregnancy related.
That's what I thought. So I couldn't buy that it was a complete accident of fate that she'd done it when she had a big thing going on in her pelvis as well. And it was quite instant, as it turned out.
So from the perspective then of somebody who's in urinary retention, our job as an acute medic in that situation is, aside from obviously treating the retention itself, which had already been done, is to try and identify causes of the retention before we get to that pregnancy call. It's things like the urinary tract infection that you mentioned, making sure that she's not severely constipated can sometimes cause urinary retention. So I'd make sure that that wasn't the case. Looking at neurological causes, which you've talked about, and you said they didn't really have any signs or symptoms of chordoglossia, and medication as well, which she wasn't taking any, so it would be unlikely. So moving forwards wise, 14 weeks, catheter's removed.
Yeah, and she's passing urine normally. What I found really strange was that it doesn't happen more often, because when I read it, I was like, yeah, this all makes perfect sense. You have a growing organ there. It's going to be occluding certain things and pressing on certain things. But in fact, it's actually super rare, like it's case report rare, rather than I made a little joke, but I'm not sort of judging obviously for not knowing what it was or saying that it was nothing to do with them. Because to be fair, I don't think a lot of people have heard of it. But it was something to do with the power of the group brain and asking someone who's all comers. Everyone's going to come through that ED. So asking them if they have a little bit of input is actually a really valuable resource. And, you know, everyone who's listening, please know that consultants get stuck. And we ask each other
all
and say,
I
don't know where to go.
Yeah. I think as a consultant as well, I'm much... Yeah, I now know I don't know. Whereas I think when I was a trainee, I didn't know what I didn't know. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Whereas now I know what I don't know, and I'm aware of my limitations, of which there are many. And the power of the collective brain can never be overemphasized enough, because I also think as a consultant, people look up to us and think you know everything. And sometimes it's really hard to ask for help and to say, I need a second opinion. You know, I frequently ask colleagues, particularly in ESTEC, I'm really stuck on this case. Is there any chance I can just run it by you? And when you're running it by each other and you're talking it through, you're like, okay, that makes sense now. And it's sometimes, you know, it's really hard to ask help because it feels like sort of admitting that you don't know things, and that is challenging.
And it's something I've become more comfortable with the longer I've been a consultant. And I think when I was a qualified consultant, I still felt like I had something to prove. particularly because I became a consultant at the same hospital where I'd been the registrar. So all of my now consultant colleagues were yesterday my bosses. And so it took a while for my new identity to sort of settle in, just for me, but also in the group dynamic as well. I was no longer registrar. I was Ben, the consultant colleague. And, you know, that's just, it's a little, everyone's very nice about it, but it feels a little bit different. Yeah. And you sort of want to know how to deal with absolutely everything yourself, because you want to justify this amazing job they've given you and the responsibility that comes with it. And it took a while for me to A, ask for help, and B, be comfortable with what I don't know. Now I'll say I don't know a lot. Don't know. Yeah. I didn't know that. You know, if I'm working with a registrar who usually works in, say, cardiology or endocrine and diabetes, and they'll say stuff, I go, oh, we don't do that now. We do this. I go, oh, wow, I didn't know that. That's really interesting. And I'm happy to learn from them. Whereas maybe when I was a new consultant, I had to sort of wear the mask of, yeah, I knew that. And that mask dissolved years ago, I'm happy to say. And I don't think I've sacrificed any respect from them or any sort of their opinion from them. Hopefully they don't think that I'm thick. But I still am able to do my job because I know where to go for help. And even if I go to my consultant colleagues and they don't know either, they're usually pretty good at coming up with a plan. So saying, I have no idea, Ben, I've never seen that before, but if I were you, I'd do ABC. And that way you can make sure that the patient's safety netted and you've got the right follow-up and you haven't missed this. So it's still useful, even in the absence of a diagnosis, for making a plan.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think the when we don't know, when we are dealing with uncertainty, diagnostic uncertainty, which you were in this situation, and even if, you know, if you hadn't had your colleague who'd said to you, oh, it could be this, like you say, you work through that. Okay, so I'm not sure what's going on, but I'm going to make sure it's not an infection, it's not medication, it's not neurological. And you have like your rule ins and your rule outs, don't you, to try and help formulate a diagnosis. I'm not sure I would have ever got to that diagnosis. However, now, having heard this case, if this happens and I see this type of case in acute medicine, I'll be like, I remember when I did a podcast on this. And I guess that's part of the podcast, actually, is talking about cases that we may or may not see very frequently, and that, you know, when people see them, like, oh, I heard about this somewhere. And you know, we know that the power of that's really, really valuable.
Yeah. If someone ever said, I've heard this on Ben and Amy's podcast in their clinical work, then, you know, I'll die a very happy man. And that's the equivalent of someone saying to me on WhatsApp, oh, I've heard of this, and passing it on. We'll be your friend in the know. Sometimes.
Yeah. Absolutely. So from that case then, what do you want us to take away from that?
I think I would take away the if you don't know, ask, basically. Much easier to say now from my point of view. And I'm very aware that if you're an FY1 or an SHO or a newly qualified ACP or whoever, asking for help has slightly different feeling and different ramifications, because of course you want people to know that you're good at your job. And I remember, you know, I very distinctly saying, if I keep saying to my consultant supervisor as a trainee doctor, I don't know, I don't know, he's going to think I don't know stuff. That's going to come back in my feedback. That's going to come back in my ARCPs. That's going to come back at my 60 degrees, doesn't know stuff. But I realize it's not as psychologically safe saying I don't know and asking for help at different levels of training and different levels of experience. But I would say, no matter where you are in your career, work out how you can safely ask for help. Identify people who are going to give it to you without judgment, without disrespect, without any sarcastic comments, out of a true desire to teach, because you're there to learn. If you knew everything from day one, then what's the point? So seek out those channels of support. And this may be, you know, an anonymized WhatsApp group with your clinical friends, or it may be a one-on-one. But find someone who you think is a safe person to approach you and say, I'm stuck. Where do I go from here? Because that's what training is. We're supposed to be giving feedback in cases like this.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. It's about finding your, I guess it's almost like your work family who you can turn to when you need some support with those diagnostic challenges. Absolutely. Thank you so much, Ben, for sharing that case. It was interesting and educational on many fronts as ever. Thank you to everybody out there who's listening. Please rate, review, and send us emails if you're really enjoying the podcast, and, you know, maybe some suggestions about what you'd like to cover or talk about in the future. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
You've been listening to the Home of Medicine podcast, a podcast brought to you by the EFIM Academy in association with the European Federation of Internal Medicine, a leading organisation in internal medicine. Thanks for listening.